Welcome to Ever Beyond, Beyond.
Broadcast through the Wolf Spirit Media Network.
Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, beyond.
Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Yes, you are. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. You're listening to JP on Ever Beyond, on Ever Beyond Radio, which broadcasts through the network. Pulsating throughout time and space. Apparently we're big on Aldebaran and not bad on Cassiopeia. We've got a growing following on Cassiopeia and certainly on Alpha Ceti. So, welcome to Interstellar and future listeners, those who are not in this particular time-space attention moment. We will be recorded and replayed ad infinitum, and it will be available on all of the archives available in the Galactic Hardware Store. So, for today, it's the 9th of April, 2017. I wake up every morning and think, 2007, this is amazing. I didn't think I was going to get through the 90s or even the 80s when I was young. I remember. Anyway, meanwhile, my guest tonight is a voice who is familiar to those of us who have been listening to the station for a while. I've just moved his show to Monday night. So those of you who haven't heard of him, now you're going to get to know him a little bit. And his name is Knighton Warbeck. Knighton, good evening. How are you?
Good evening, JP. I'm very well, thank you. How is everything on your side of the pond?
Oh, the pond. Well, actually, you know, you were saying you're in snow. Here in Scotland, we have daffodils and spring and stuff. It's really nice. And all my chickens have left home and they're sitting on their little clutch of half a dozen eggs thinking, I'm going to make these hatch. Yes.
Wow.
Well, but they try it every year. Never worked. Anyway, go ahead, please. Sorry.
I have a question for you. And this question really comes from Canadian culture, or maybe I should say North American culture. Are you ready?
There he was gone. Anyway, go on. Ask me the question. It's one of these Canadian questions, isn't it?
Yeah. How much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
Oh, about a chuck's worth. So.
Shall I give you the answer?
What's the answer in Kanukistanese?
No, I'm gonna give you the answer in Scottish British terms. Are you ready?
Okay, go on.
About 25 pounds of bullocks.
Which indeed is the farm. I live on a bullock farm. They raise bullocks from about, I suppose they're about 6 months old and they're, more or less, pretty big cow-like thing, but not quite fully grown, until they're about 2 years old. And then they slaughter them and make them into hamburgers.
Hamburgers are okay. Yeah. And I'm going to do something I think is probably banned. I've been listening to you and Simon quite a bit.
Oh, yes. So, and onions, garlic, and hamburger.
At your breaks, I see that Simon opts for a spot of tea. Spot of tea? Is that correct? A cup of tea?
Oh, a spot of tea, yes, yeah.
Spot of tea, sorry. My Scottish is not very good.
Yeah, because he's not. So, we're both from London. There's no Scottish in it at all.
Oh, thank God for that.
Okay, yeah, that's so why we haven't got those accents that lift. So, have you seen that one? There's this brilliant sketch from Berniston. There's an old TV comedy, and it's about two Scottish guys with a Glaswegian accent getting into a lift that has American voice recognition, and it can't hear what they're saying. I love on. Just type in 11 into YouTube. It'll get there. You'll see two guys in a lift. Watch that sketch. It's the funniest thing. Meanwhile.
I bet they couldn't even call for help. So I'm going to do something that Simon cannot do or will not do. And maybe that's because I don't have that English politeness to me. And by the way, for all of you listening around the world, being a Canadian means we're half American and half British. I don't know if people quite understand that, but I'm actually going to drink tea during our time here on air. And I always notice that Simon always saves it for the break. So is Simon unable to multitask, or is he just being really, really polite?
Simon is from a very upper middle class English zone. And so unlike me, right, which is like you, I have a little tower here that's got a candle on it that keeps my cup of tea warm during the whole show. So I can have a cup of tea that lasts, and I can just take a little sip at a time during the times when I'm not speaking, which hopefully will be quite a lot this evening, because you've got a lot of interesting stuff to talk about. So I always like to hear what you've got to say. So I have a cup of tea here. So we're kind of lower middle class, you know, maybe sort of upper working class kind of British here, sort of
having
our tea as we're having a chat.
We're going to slum it just a little bit.
And maybe we're outside having a smoke as well, you know, with a cup of tea by the fire.
Or we could be in our boxer shorts as well, and no one would ever know. That'll be our little secret.
Or you could even be, as you said before, outside on your back garden, smoking a cigar in the snow.
Yes, prepping for today, and also getting ready for the time slot on Monday.
Right. So, and this is the thing. All right, because Knighton is a host on Wolf Spirit Radio and has been for a while, but like I say, you've been pretty, I don't know, what can I say, sidelined, you know, put in this place because, you don't do it live, so people have fitted it in. And I decided to bring you, further forward and put you into a more prime time slot. Because previously Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, not many people are going to be around. Please, Knighton, your show is like nothing you've ever heard before. That's your strap line.
It is.
Why?
Well, I remember Dave had contacted me. Dave Corso, the King, of course, I call him, and we must always thank Dave. And I remember I was, I'd come back from Singapore in, late, 2011. And I didn't know what to do with my life exactly. I wasn't quite sure the direction I was going to take. I've got quite a big bag of tricks that I can pull from, and I knew that I wanted to be more. My motto, I guess, in life is to be the ultimate version of myself. And I used to stutter horribly from age 6 to age 34. That was damn near 30 years of stuttering. And one day at age 34, I woke up and suddenly I could speak at 80%. So Dave overheard a interview that Rebecca Jernigan and I had put on, and Rebecca had said, "Hey, Dave wants to speak with you." So we got on the horn and talked, and he says, "Hey, how about your own radio show?" And I was freaked out. I just wasn't ready. That was in April of 2012, and I wasn't quite sure of the direction of my life and my message that I wanted to do, because I had done very specific work for about 11 years, and I was really quite burnt out on that. So about a year later, in April of 2013, I said, "Okay, Dave, let's do it." And I thought at the time that Saturday morning would be prime time. I thought, oh, people are home, and maybe they'll just have their, you know, the radio going or the internet and tune in. And now I've been told that really isn't the case, that Monday night is the prime time. So I said, "Okay, Dave, let's do it." And he asked me, he said, what kind of a time slot do you want? Do you want to do, an hour a day, 3 hours a day, once a month, whatever? And I said, "Let's start off with maybe every Saturday." So we went from there. And after the first show, actually the very first show, there was no archive of it. He had three machines that were supposed to record. I was recording on my end, and none of it, absolutely none of it,
recorded. The early days, I remember them. Nothing would work. Even if you made it, if you told these things, "Work, please." They just refused to. Yeah, go on.
So I guess it really wasn't meant to be. And I found that very, very funny. And when I asked him initially about listenership, I said, what do we max out on Wolf Spirit Radio? And he said, well, depending on the show and depending on the guest, it could be anywhere from 60,000 to 100,000. And I said, fantastic. Great. So after the first show, I think it was a day or two later or later on in that week, I said, how many did we have? And he said, 17.
That was a good day. That was a very good day.
I guess 17 is better than 16, and we can only go up from here. Now, my show is memories, shared life experiences of my life. And I had this this really great mentor who passed away in October of 2016. And she was a huge teacher for me. I met her back in 1999. She was from New Zealand. Very, very gifted spiritual healer. Very gifted, intuitive person. And she said, you know what, Knighton, you must stand in your truth. And I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And she always harped on me. She said, you always have to stand in your truth. So these experiences that I share on the radio, it will be like nothing you've heard before because these are my experiences and this is my truth. And it's wacky. It's interesting. It's odd. It's confusing. It is perplexing. And I remember after, oh my gosh, maybe it was 3 months and I did maybe a dozen shows or so. And Dave said, you know what? I keep getting emails from people. And people, they're saying, who is this Knighton guy? And what the heck is he talking about? And I said, okay, I can't really explain it. I can't help people understand it. I can just talk about it. And it is just a collection of my stories. I have somewhat of a unique story. And everybody actually that's walking the face of the earth also has a unique story. And I decided to share these, talk about them. And it may click for some people. It may not. Tomorrow night show, a Monday night show, is going to be about my experiences. I worked for 3 years in the early 90s, age 19, 20, and 21 as a male model. So then people are going to say, okay, Wolf Spirit Radio is based off of, you know, truth and reaching your full potential and understanding who you are, working on your intuition, trying to understand the world, you know, connect the dots, put the pieces of the puzzle together to try to make some sense. So how is it that you talking about working as a male model for 3 years, how is that going to help me? And I say to you, I have no idea. I really don't know. But what I've done in my life and what I've accomplished and overcome my major challenge, which really was to speak, this was part of it. This is part of character building. And in early December, actually the morning of the 10th of December in 2016, I was in a serious car accident and I lost my marbles. I'm still in rehab and recovering from numerous physical injuries. But the worst part was is that I'm still suffering 4 months later of symptoms of a very, very severe concussion. And I began, really sort of piecing my life together, sort of rebuilding about a month and a half to maybe 2 months ago. And I actually took a break from doing shows because I'm just not able to access data, not able to think complex and very, very deep. And also, sometimes now I still have trouble finding words. I slur my words because of the brain injury called a concussion. So part of my therapy for me, you know, I'm in physiotherapy, massage therapy. I'm being sent out in about 2-3 weeks for some cognitive therapy as well. I'm going to be treated and assessed and helped by about 4 or 5 doctors. And part of sort of piecing it back together is looking at old photos, old photos, going back to when I was, you know, 6 or 7 years old and right up until now. I'll be 45 years old in June, on the 8th of June, and sort of doing this self-help therapy. I came across these photos of when I used to model for 3 years. And this brought back a lot of great memories because through this concussion, I have basically forgotten who I am. It's kind of like this amnesia. And it's very debilitating. It's very tough emotionally, obviously intellectually as well, to live like this, but I'm doing the best that I can. So I'm going to be talking about my experiences, and this is also a healing process for me. And the point that I'm making here about, you know, what does being a male model have to do with spirituality? We go through our lives really not understanding or not realizing that we live incredible lives. We do incredible things. I'm not a father. I'd like to be a father one day, but for those of you who have children, you know, that is a huge step. That is a huge accomplishment. And to not, you know, grab your child by the scruff of his or her neck and yell at them, but to maintain your calm and your composure is a great thing. You know, having your heart broken and then the very next day finding the love of your life is also something that's very, very special. So for me, as I share my experiences in my life, I end up sort of piecing it together that, hey, you know what, I'm a somebody and so are you. So things that seem very, very small, if you tell yourself the lie that, you know, well, I'm a nobody and I can't do much and I have nothing, you know, great to give to the world. I mean, that is just rubbish. So looking back at these photos and bringing back all these memories and sort of piecing together the journey of my life, I can see that, hey, this is kind of neat and I feel better about some hard times and difficult times that I'm going through now. So I want people to, when they tune in and listen to me talk about all kinds of stuff, it may not make sense. It may not seem to be of any help, but just hang in there and one day you'll get it. And I'm not saying that my message is any greater than anybody else's or my life. You know, I've lived in 5 countries on 4 continents. I pursued goals and dreams, sold everything I had to go for it. Lived a life of great adventure, excitement compared to some people. And of course, it's all relative. And some people have done 100 times more than me and traveled more and are smarter and are funnier and better looking and better spoken and all of these things. But I talk about things on my show that happened to me, things on my show that happened to other people. And then somehow I feel I'm quite successful in tying it into some type of a message. Whether it's to inspire you, maybe it's to shake you out of your sleep or what have you. So it's really great to be here. I'm glad to be here on Monday. And when I got the news that I wasn't going to be doing the Saturday time slot, I was actually quite disappointed. I was a little bit upset. And then I just sat back and said, okay, you know, things happen for a reason and put the reactive side away and just let it settle. And it turns out within, I don't know, was it 10 or 15 minutes, JP, I just messaged you and said, hey, what's going on? And right away, you came back and say, come on over to Monday. Let's do it. So the model for my show is like nothing you've heard before. I worked for 11 years as an elite freelance consultant. For 18 months over those 11 years, I worked for a private network of global billionaires. And what I do is called geomancy. I am a geomancer, and geomancy means to recognize patterns or pattern, you know. So a geomancer is one who recognizes these patterns and then shares them. So I had a very interesting meeting way back in 1999. I think it was 99. And I met this very, very well-connected, very wealthy, very powerful Jew from New York City. His family owned a law firm, and he was a corporate or a corporation lawyer. And this incredible meeting had totally, totally changed my life. And what was so fascinating was I was about 27 to 28 when I met this this man from New York City. And he actually, to look at him, God, he's kind of like a cross between Al Pacino and maybe Paul Simon and one other in there, a short little guy, great sense of humor, very distinguished looking. And before that, I had actually sold everything I had, and I pursued my dream, my goal of being a professional bodybuilder. So when I was just turned 23, I decided I want to shape my body, and I wanted to be very well built, and I wanted to be on a stage, and I wanted to compete. I began lifting weights when I was 12 years old. I wanted to be faster and better for hockey. I've been playing hockey since I was 5 years old. Very, very typically, you know, Canadian thing to do. And I sold everything I had, went to Australia, and came back just over a year later, completely shattered in every single way. And the main reason why I just couldn't pursue bodybuilding anymore or stay in Australia is that when I was 19 years old, I had a head-first motorcycle accident. I went headfirst into a car door, doing about 40 miles an hour, about 60 kilometers an hour, and was solidly laid out for 2 weeks and off work for 7 months. And that was my first serious concussion. And I didn't get the help that I needed. I didn't get my family doctor. I got shafted. I got shafted by the lawyer and the lawsuit and everything else. I didn't get the help that I needed. So 5 years later, at the end of my stay in Australia when I was 24 years old, I just couldn't do any more exercises. I had pain in the neck, shoulders, upper back. It was just horrific, lower back. And out of the 35 to 40 prime exercises I needed to do to build my body up to 280 pounds, I could do five. And those five, I was in excruciating pain. So I came back to Canada, absolutely shattered in every single way, emotionally, mentally, physically, financially, spiritually. And I moped around for 3 years, and I just didn't want to be on the planet. And I remember my best friend, Sean, whom I met when I was, grade 8, 13 years old. Still my best friend today. We're like soul brothers. And he was in Aikido, the Japanese martial art Aikido. And he said, why don't you have a session with my master? He was a seventh degree black belt in Aikido. And if you don't know what Aikido is, think of Steven Seagal, the great American actor. Steven Seagal is a master of Aikido, this Japanese martial art. So Sean said, have a session with Brad. And I did. I sat down. I scraped up my only $60. I was absolutely, again, shattered in every single way. Could barely put food in the fridge. And I had a soul lessons reading with him. And he basically read my soul. And he said, I want you to pick five things that you want to do, five things that interest you. One of them was writing, which I have a natural talent for. Two, the second one was I wanted to be a tailor. I wanted to design men's suits, because I had a background in fashion and modeling. And there were a few others that don't remember. Oh, one was to continue the bodybuilding, but that obviously wasn't going to work because my body was just completely smashed. So we went through all that, and at the end of the session, as I was literally walking out of the door about to cross the threshold, he says, oh, wait, just a minute. He says, I have one more piece of information. I said, okay. He says, you're going to meet a man. This man will be a stranger, and this man is going to change your life. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Do you have a time frame? Any idea? And he said, 3, maybe 4 years. About 4 years later, 3 to 4 years later, I met this man from New York City, and he changed my life. And what he did was he passed on some very valuable information. And this was information that he paid $1 million for. And he just gave it to me on a silver platter. And he basically said to me during our 3-year apprenticeship master relationship, he said to me after, oh God, it must have been maybe after the second month, third month. He said, you know, Knighton, he says, I have been wanting to share this information with somebody worthy for 30 years. And I said, well, L.L. Chopin is what I call him. I said, I've been waiting almost 30 years to come into this kind of information. And we spent 3 years together, a lot of time. I spent many weeks at a time out at his mountain resort retreat in British Columbia, Canada, and Western Canada. He married a Canadian. That's why he was in Canada. And after the 3 years had passed, we had this really unusual ending. It was very, very bizarre. Just overnight, our relationship just had evaporated, and boom, I was on my own. And it was about maybe a year or 2 years later. So that was 1999, year 2000, 2001. And in 2003, yeah, about 2 years, in 2003, I erected a website. And I decided, okay, this information that LL had really just gifted, it's almost like I had inherited it. I said, why don't I turn this into a business? Why don't I make this a career? And why don't I teach this, share with others this knowledge, or even consult businesses to become more efficient and proficient? And I worked and worked to work on my life and to master myself, my issues, my challenges, my problems, and eventually taught myself more about this particular system, applied it in my life, had phenomenal results, and said, okay, now I'm ready to take this out into the world. And as I was doing this, I still needed to fund myself. I needed to finance myself. LL and I had talked about he putting me on an allowance, a monthly allowance of, it was going to be about $3,000 to $3,500 US every month, which for me at the time, I mean, that was a huge amount of money because I could, you know, I could barely put, rub two pennies together. So I funded and financed myself, and part of that was working on oil drilling rigs or drilling for natural gas in the province of Alberta, from really where I'm from. This is considered the Saudi Arabia of Canada, or it's considered Texas. Texas is known for a lot of oil in the U.S. and obviously Saudi Arabia. So you can always find this very grueling and challenging and very dangerous work here in this jurisdiction. So I did this on and off for 2 years. I worked summers at 40 degrees Celsius, 110 degrees Fahrenheit, sweltering heat and humidity. And in the winter, I did, winters, I did 30 days at a time up north, way up north in Canada. And we were looking at daytime lows of minus 45 Celsius. That's around 50 below Fahrenheit. And then at the nights, evenings, it would drop to about minus 50 Celsius. That's about minus 58 Fahrenheit. And I did that, and I could work 1 month, and if I was very frugal with my spending, I could take 4 months off, and this would allow me to pursue research, deal with clients for free or at a very low charge to get results, feedback on the information that I had gave them. And through this, I got very, very good at it. In this particular area in the world, I'm the only one doing it. I'm the only one investigating it, I feel. I'm the only one who was teaching it, sharing it. I did seminars. I did my own public speaking overseas in Singapore in 2009 to 2011. So I funded and financed everything on my own, very self-learned, self-taught, very, very efficient and proficient on my own. And one thing led to another, A, B, C, D, E, F, and G down to Z or Z, as we say in Canada and Britain as well, Z. I rubbed shoulders with certain people. And before I knew it, I was helping this network of this global private network of billionaires. We took a project, it was about 18 months, and we went from literally zero to the company being worth, I just very conservatively say $350 million, but probably in the $500+ million after 18 months. And then I took one success and built upon another, and then found myself in Singapore, fulfilling the mission, accomplishing the mission was to speak. Because when I was very young, of course, not being able to speak and say what I wanted to say, every word, I mean, just every letter in the alphabet just gave me trouble. And I had this goal from a very young age, which was actually two-part. Part one was I wanted to speak. I wanted to speak fluently. I wanted to say what I wanted to say. I wanted to say it under my terms, my conditions. Because as a professional stutterer, I had to rehearse seconds, minutes, even days in advance what I wanted to say. So I actually rewired my brain in such a way that I actually tapped into my intuition. So I actually taught myself to be very intuitive. So the first part was to speak. And then if I could do the first part, then there was a second part. Any idea what the second part is, JP?
The first part? I can hear myself. I don't know. What would be the second part?
Second part was I wanted to build something. I wanted to build something. I had no idea what. You know,
things are things, aren't they? I mean, there's a thing that is a thing, but there's an idea that's a thing. A website is a thing, isn't it? A radio station's a thing, isn't it?
Yes.
But is it a building a thing, an edifice a thing, like a mountain?
I really didn't know what. All I knew, and again, we're talking about knowing, right? This inner knowing. We're talking about intuition. We're talking about tapping into your psychic ability. And it's not important when these things come to us that we know exactly what it is and have all the details, only that we know. So I knew that I wanted to build something. If I could speak, I wanted to build something. Now, I didn't go to school to be an engineer, an architect, not in construction. My father, who was a fighter pilot in the Canadian Air Force, he retired a full colonel, he loved to do woodworking in his spare time. That really didn't appeal to me either. I didn't know how to weld. So I knew that it wasn't going to be anything, let's say, tangible or physical. I wasn't going to build a building or build a bridge. And what I was building was my life. And actually being here with you today and all the listeners, this is part of the thing that I'm building.
Absolutely. Here we are.
Right. So I have avenues I wish to go down. One of my goals is I wish to be a globally known, or at least North America-wide known, public speaker. I'd love to speak in front of large audiences. One thing that was very sad for me, and probably the reason why I'm single and did not marry this person, was my girlfriend in Singapore said something that was really quite hurtful. And it really knocked the wind out of my sails. And I think it showed her true colors or her true character. Or it just showed that she didn't appreciate or respect my greatest accomplishment. And that was to speak. So I would do a seminar in Singapore. And, I'd be up talking for 7, 8, 9 hours, breaks here and there, sharing this technology that my mentor from New York City had shared with me, and then I expanded on it a thousandfold. And after the seminar, people would obviously want to have access to me one-on-one, so I would speak with them one-on-one. And it was almost like we had like a little mini seminar after that, because I'd have the seminar with the audience, and then I'd have this other smaller audience and be talking and sharing. They'd ask questions and so forth. And I think this annoyed her for some reason. I don't know why. And I think it was probably, I would do the seminar maybe 7, 8 hours, 9 hours, and then I would speak to people for like another hour. And she said something to me, and I again, do this concussion. I don't know if I have the full recall of what she said, but it was something, you know, to the tune of, oh, Knight, and he can go on and on and on, as if to say, you know, this is ridiculous. It's annoying me. We've got things to do and places to go. And that really hurt me, because it said to me that she didn't understand, didn't appreciate, or didn't respect all that I had gone through. That would be like if somebody in your family or your sweetie was in a car crash and was in a wheelchair for a year or 2 years or 5 years, whatever it is. And then one day, your sweetie or your family member, someone that you care about and love, actually began to walk. And then they decide to enter a marathon, 26-mile marathon. They run the marathon, but they're so happy with themselves. They're so impressed by themselves. They keep running, kind of like in Forrest Gump, right? Just keep running and running and running. And then turning to the crowd and say, yeah, all she wants to do is run. So that is building. Building is the speaking. Building is Knight and Warbeck Radio here on wolfspiritradio.com. The building is to speak in front of an audience, and there's other things that I'm piecing together. Now, what is the final vision of this building? I know, but I don't know. I have an idea. It's still there. And with this idea, this knowing obviously is a feeling. So then I just continue along the feeling. And what is the feeling? The feeling is I feel good what I'm doing. If I don't feel good, I discontinue it. I reassess and I said, okay, maybe I need to go on a similar stream, similar direction on the spider web, but make some alterations so that it feels good. So have you ever done anything in your life like this, JP, where you've had a feeling and you don't quite know what the end result is? You don't know how you're going to get there. You don't know what you're going to do or who you're going to talk to, but you just know that you have to stay on this path.
You ride on the feeling. Yeah. Okay. It's like trying to balance a ball on top of another ball. To try and hold on to the feeling.
Yeah, that's actually, in British terms, that's brilliant.
Thank you. But yeah, it's elusive, and you have to kind of nurture it carefully to stay with it. But if you do, it really pays dividend because it takes you exactly where you need to go next. And it's surprisingly efficient because you're speaking directly from your heart and you're acting exactly in the moment. And if you can do those two things at the same time, then, you know, that's exactly what you've been talking about, isn't it? Being completely active and being a human on this.
Yes. Yeah, so do you think that our listeners or most people walk in the street, do you think that they do this or are they afraid or is there some type of a block? Is there maybe inner knowing isn't there?
I think that a lot of them do, and those who aren't will, and those who do will also step forward and start teaching like you have.
So do you think that this is part of or maybe the mission?
It is the plan.
What about for Wolf Spirit Radio? Do you think when Dave Corso put this together and ceremoniously handed all of us the reins on his passing, do you think that this was part of his goal, was to have people to follow their heart and get on their mission and listen to that inner knowing? Because Dave was amazingly intuitive.
Absolutely. I think really what the inner plan, as it were, is to go from PTSD to intuitive leadership. That means leading from the heart. You know, whatever happens, you deal with it immediately in the moment and you know exactly the right thing to do. It's just the most obvious thing. And it's just like, what would be the most kind thing? You know, it's like, it's the opposite of being mean and businesslike. It's like the opposite of that. Heartful. Go ahead.
I think that without even knowing it, Dave has been, was, is, will always be a leader for all of us in that we have been so emotionally traumatized by media, things in our lives, blah, 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 that we all suffer from PTSD and that we really need to heal ourselves. There was no speech therapist that could help me. There was no doctor. There was no physiotherapy. There was no prescription pill. There was no herb. There was nothing that could help me. And I knew that. I knew deep down inside that this was my thing that I needed to overcome. This was my number one goal, was to speak. And I knew that only I could do it. Sure, I had a lot of help, a lot of mentors who helped me indirectly. But I had to go inside. Internally, deep, deep down, and I had to face my demons and I needed to have courage. Now, I couldn't just run down to the corner store, to the local pub and say, hey, give me a glass of courage. I had to figure it out on my own. And I think Dave having PTSD, which he did, obviously, he needed to go inside as well. and find his answers. His case, I think, was obviously probably, you know, much more deep and much more intense than us.
Yeah. Well, most people, it's accidental, but we're aware that with Dave, it was, you know, it was consciously and deliberately imposed by somebody, who, you know, was not going along with Dave's free will. You know, this is the whole thing. It was like, that's the worst thing that anyone can do. Yeah. And he did recover from it.
Yes.
And, he managed to integrate many of his alters and, you know, he set them to work. And that's, that's why he was able to do a radio station 7 days or 6 days a week. I can't do it 6 days a week. I can just about do it two. So he was able to channel the enormous angst energy of that into putting it into service.
Now, would you believe me if I told you, or any of the listeners believe me if I told everybody, that actually I have been healed through this show, through Wolf Spirit Radio, and by some guests or hosts on the show?
Well, that's another success story. Do you want to relate some of those? That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. I believe the reason why I began to stutter is through my father. My father was a very impatient man. He was pretty screwed up too. His father was quite vicious. And I said, okay, my father is a better version of his father, so I want to be a better version of my father. And hopefully one day I'll have a family and have a son or daughter, and they'll be a better version than I am, a better version of me. Now, due to his impatience and his psychological warfare, which is very typical of military, being in the Air Force, the way that you make it to the top and progress through the ranks is through fear. It's fear-based. And my father made it his goal in life to have me feel, the words I want to say, growing up, he made me feel totally useless and incompetent. And he wanted things now. He always wanted the answer now. And I'm snapping my fingers. He would say something and we would have to give him the answer. We can never ask why, because it was a very military type structure, growing up, which was great. You know, I've a lot of great discipline. I try to be as clean cut as I can. Bed is made, shoes are shiny and so forth. But through this, I just couldn't get the answers out fast enough. And I felt that created a pattern for me, which really ultimately came out as affecting my speech. Now, my father passed away 2.5 years ago. And I hadn't spoken to him for 17 years. Basically, at age 24, actually in my late teens, I had tried to be friends with him because we had a posting to Belgium, Mons, Belgium, 60 kilometers, 40 miles south of Brussels. And he had a posting at SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe. And his abuses, which are just mental and verbal and psychological, I mean, this man could give you a look and it could kill. Amazing. And it got so bad, JP, that my mother and I went to the BX, the base exchange, and got two of the biggest suitcases that they had. And we left them one day when I was 16 years old, and that's how we escaped. It was amazing because we ended up getting to the airports in Brussels, all covertly, very secretively. And the airplane was already being pushed away from the boarding, I don't know what you call it, but that the boarding gate, the gate. And it was being pushed out, and we were running and screaming, my mother and I, because we had to get away from the abuse, screaming, hold the airplane. And today that would never happen. Once that sucker's gone, she's gone, but they end up pulling it back, and we thanked profusely and told a story, and they said, no problem, we're happy to help you. So it was a very, very difficult time when I was 16, and I tried being friends with them three times. I actually flew out. He was a base commander in Trenton in Ontario on the eastern side of Canada. And after my accident, my motorcycle accident when I was 19, and I tried three times to be friends with him, and he just wasn't able to. I think he wanted to, but he just didn't know how, right? And this is, you know, our father's generation where you don't talk about your problems. You suck it up, buttercup, get on with the show. And I tried three times, and after the third time, I think I was probably 21 or 22. I remember I just had given up. I just, you know, I can't do it anymore. You know, I've had enough abuse, and why am I coming to him? It was wrong, you know? And when I left for Australia, I was 23, and the day after I left, he phoned. And my roommate said, you know, you're one day late. And when I came back from Australia, being totally shattered in every single way, I just decided to write him a letter. It was a 7-page letter, and I told him to F off very politely. I said, you know, I hope you make general. You're, you know, very close to making general. That's your goal. Your lifelong dream has been to make general. And I hope it works for you, but we just have there's nothing between us. And I need to carve out my own future, be my own man, and so forth. So I made it a career to hate him for 17 years. And I heard that he was sick, and I had no contact with him, and he passed away. And I asked my mother, who also suffered, you know, 22 years, and then finally got the divorce, but 22 years of the psychological abuse by this man. And I said, are we going to go to the funeral? And she looked at me and she said, son, she said, why would we honor the life of a man who made it his mission in life to destroy us? I said, you're right. And along comes Joanna the medium. And I heard an interview with you and her. This was probably 8 months ago. I think it was 8 months, something like that.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because I was talking to you about Audrey. I said, hey, we got a real E.T. on the show. And you got to listen to this guy. So I said, check out this video. And you completely ignored Audrey and you know, zoned in on the gorgeous beauty. Ooh. and
bada boom bada bing.
Oh, bless your beating heart. So when it came down to about sort of 90 over 60, what was you were supposed to be hearing the thing about the ET guy, and but you heard Joanna. What happened? What was the bada bing? Did your heart start beating? You know, things like that happen, you know.
I heard this voice and I just connected with her right away. And, I taught myself to be intuitive. I do something called property defrag. I change things using my mind. I'm very connected with the earth and I make changes in the right, condition, the right emotional, mental, spiritual state. And I change matter using my consciousness. And I tuned in with her and I was taken back to a past life I had with her. It's amazing. Some people need to do a regression. Some people need help for past life, and I can just access it at will. And I've done many. And I had this connection with Joanna, and all I heard was the voice. So I got on, you know, I do the Google investigation, with her, and I'm like, wow, this woman, yeah, she's, drop dead gorgeous, but there's something more. So I tuned in, and amazingly, I saw myself with her. And the number comes up, 1789, possibly the Cook Islands. I was an officer in His Majesty's Navy, and she was a local. And I brought her gifts of lace. I was very sweet on her. She was sweet on me. And that was the connection. So I sent her an email, and a few emails back and forth. Then we got on the phone, and I told her about this past life. And then she filled in her half. And I think she betrayed me or something. I can't remember. But anyways, we just started this great friendship, and she's out in Vancouver, which is on the West Coast. And I'm not too far from her because I'm also in Western Canada. And we began talking and talking, and just this really great friendship has bloomed and blossomed. And she helped me with my father. My father, obviously, felt bad as soon as he passed on the other side, you know, felt bad about everything. And I was still quite miffed and upset because I had spent 17 years, you know, basically hating him and then, wanting to basically ignore, everything so I could move on, and, did my best to put it out of my mind. And then now I was having this 1-hour conversation with my father through Joanna. And the end of it, after, it was probably a month, JP, month or 6 weeks after we first were conversing and my father was speaking through her, and bang on, boom, 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 bang on. I mean, Joanna, I mean, that's, it doesn't get any better than her. Phenomenal.
I just want to, again, Joanna the Medium, Monday night, 6 to 7, Pacific, and the Knighton is, I've got
7 till 8.
7 till 8 and 8 till 9 is Knighton Warbeck. So we got these two back to back, curiously linked from a past life, both in Western Canukia.
Yep.
It can't get more intriguing and mysterious than that.
Oh,
I'm sure, actually, you're going to tell me how it can be, can't you?
So we end up communicating, father, and I finally forgave him. And it took a while because it was so uncomfortable. And I felt that forgiving him made me vulnerable. I felt like I had no defenses. I had to rewire my everything. I had to rewire how I thought, how I felt, the memories, the visions, the difficult times, the fun times, which are very few and far between. And one day I just forgave him and my life had shifted. And Joanna said, she said, you know, in our relationship in this lifetime, she says, I'm here to crack you open like an egg. And I
that's very like her to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I still get on Skype. I, usually we chat every day and share things. And, of course, with all of my, with my thing, like nothing you've heard before, she thinks I'm just crazy, a genius and brilliant, so forth. But I have different, very, very different views from Joanna, from all your other guests, from Simon, from you, because I do my own thing and I stand in my truth. And I don't disagree with anybody. I just offer a much different perspective, and it may or may not fly with you or not. But going back to Joanna, she helped me with my father. Fantastic. So I've been healed through wolfspiritradio.com, through everything, through UJP, because you had the interview with Joanna, that I got in tune with her, and now we have great conversations, and it's just a wonderful thing. And whatever Joanna's charging for her services, it is worth it.
Every cent, every dollar, every penny, it's worth it. You know, when I first met her, she did a reading on me, and I said, you know, I just went, I said, all right, tell me what my guides tell me to say, tell you to say. And she says, I see this enormous, huge, giant bird-like, bird-faced being. I'm going, God, is she talking to a thoth? And it just poured this beautiful, poetic, honey-colored message. It was beautiful. It was about how we'll heal everything through love and love alone, you know. And this is how it's happening. This is, you know, what you're talking about. It's all through love.
You know, so many people, even the ones that are on the fringe, or those of us who listen to WolfSpiritRadio.com or the mainstream, you know, some regular person, have many questions about, you know, afterlife and death and, you know, talking to dead people and all these things. And that's, I also communicate with those who have passed on as well. That's part of what I do. I do a whole bunch of things. And as I was talking with Joanna, and my father is there, and she's like, he's there, like he's right there. And one of my hockey sticks moved. When I first began to communicate with her about my father. Now my father loved to play hockey. He was a sportsman, was a hunter. His father is still number 3 in the all-time record books for biggest, bighorn sheep. I think he's still in the record books, 1953 or 1956, third biggest, bighorn sheep of all time. So father was very much into hockey, like I am. I almost played pro in my late teens. And he loved cigars, and I also like cigars. So I said to Joanna, I said, okay, if the old man is around and he's bored, I'm going to put him to work. I'm going to put him in charge of hockey equipment and cigars. And I think it was when I said that. That's when one of my hockey sticks behind me moved. I got about $4,000 worth of these high-end composite hockey sticks. Great amount of technology. And one of them moved. It almost fell off the rack. And that's when I really got the sign that, yeah, okay, I believe it. But all of her information she was sharing was just bang on, bang on, bang on. I'm like, this is phenomenal. There is no way that this can be a scam. There's no way that this can be a con. I have this double and triple, this double safe checking system. And I'm always testing, right? I'm always testing is what she's saying right? Am I been taken for a ride? And it's not. I'm totally sold. And it's been a huge blessing in my life. So imagine, being psychologically ransacked, by somebody in your childhood. And then harboring a very soft hatred for like 17 plus years, and then suddenly having all that lifted and gone within a matter of, you know, whether it's was, you know, 20 minutes or an hour, but then having it sink in for the next 4, 5, or 6 weeks. Imagine what that's worth to you. It's just absolutely priceless. So Joanna is just a huge blessing on Wolf Spirit Radio, and actually everybody is. And if you can find the one person or the one message or the one thing that helps you in some way, it doesn't matter where it comes from. It doesn't matter who said it. You don't have to share it with anybody. It's just that one little piece of truth to you can help you tremendously. And that, I think, would make Mr. Corso smiling as big as Texas, wherever he is, that he's managed to start something and probably keep it together on that side as well. Keep everybody working together harmoniously. Some come in, some drop out and so forth. He'd probably be a very, very happy father, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, yeah. Old Pops. I mean, I'm sure that there are times when, you know, I don't have a, like tonight, I didn't have a guest. Yeah. And there you just said, oh, I'll just be doing my show later. And I thought, maybe people need to get to know you a bit, you know, cause it's, and you got a lovely voice, but as I said, you've been tucked away in the morning zone. Let's bring you back up.
You know, I did my first, it was 2001. So I had my unusual part with my mentor, L.L. Chopin. And I say Chopin because he never wanted to be a lawyer. He never wanted to be a corporate lawyer, never wanted to follow in his father's footsteps. He went to Harvard, but then he got his law degree from Columbia. And he wanted to write music, and his father lived to be, I think, 93. I think his mother passed away, or 92 or 93. His mother passed away and she was about 94, 95. And his father was basically on his deathbed, and LL Lair is there. LL has an older brother. And he's on his, at his father's bedside. And his father had said, I mean, I saw photos of his father with Nixon in the White House. The family-owned law firm in New York City, they had a separate office inside and had a plaque on the door, and the door said Warburg Trust. So we're talking, you know, major, major players in the world of finance, politics, and so forth. Actually, LL's mentor out of law school was Max Rabb. Does that ring a bell? Max Rabb. I think it's R-A-B-B. Anyways, do your research. Pretty well up there in the inner circles. And his father said to me, he said, you didn't have to be a lawyer. And LL said, what? He said, you could have done anything you wanted. The family was worth $500 million. And LL said, what? Like, what are you talking about? He said, you could have done anything you wanted to do. You didn't have to impress me. You didn't have to be a lawyer. You didn't have to do any of that. So after my unusual parting with LL in 2001, I decided I was going to give my first seminar. And I did it in a very, very small town. LL and I had a friend named Bob. Bob was down just across the border in Washington State on the western side of America, the north, they call it the Pacific Northwest. And we had, I don't know, 20 or 30 people show up. I stuttered through the whole 2-3 hours horribly. It was an absolute disaster. I had this PowerPoint presentation that I'd probably put, you know, 500 hours in. It was way too long. I was up there talking about this information. Again, I just stuttered horribly. Because in 2001, how old was I? I was still smack dab in all the stuttering. And it was brutal. And actually, it was 2 days. It wasn't just 1 day. It was 2 days. And I remember, JP, oh my God. I had access to the radio, the local radio. And I was doing a little, kind of a little commercial advert to promote the seminar. I think it was like on a Thursday or a Friday, and the seminar was like Saturday, Sunday. It was two separate seminars on the same topic from the teachings from LL. And I'd written a book kind of with them, quasi with them. And I've actually written 4 books. They're all unpublished, just waiting for that right time. So if anybody thinks that, you know, you create something and it has to be done, it has to be, you know, published or commercialized. No. Maybe you write it for yourself or maybe 10 years down the road. So here I am, you know, 16, 17 years later, still sitting, you know, waiting patiently to be launched and released. I got on that radio. I don't know how many retakes we had to do. 40, 30, 40, 50. I stuttered so horribly. And it was so, you know, every time I would stutter, I felt such humiliation and shame. I mean, growing up, stuttering, it was like between 70 and 200 times a day. And each time...
Yeah. When you say stutter, would it be that you would you would start a syllable and then not be able to finish it and then start it again? So it was that. Or it's like you just... You know, because there's some people who just can't...
Both. Everything. All of it.
So it's like, and what did it feel like from the inside? Now you can.
It was just anguish. Absolute anguish. Yeah, frustration, but I think anguish is this, it's wrapped up with frustration. It's just absolutely debilitating. I would often, if I stuttered horribly, like really bad in front of others. Like I even did in front of families, family members and friends, and I felt shame. And sometimes I would come home and I just curl up in a ball in the fetal position in the closet, shut the doors under the table and just, wish, pray that my entire existence be wiped clean from the slate of the history of the earth. Oh. It's horrible. So let me give you one example. It was, LL had come to visit me in my city of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And there was my best friend, Sean. There was probably 8 of us, and we were looking at going out for dinner somewhere. So I decided that I was going to call a restaurant. And what is the R word when you pick up the phone and you want to book or reserve a table at a restaurant? What do you call that? Starts with an R.
Well, you said a reservation, yeah?
Reservation, that's right. I got on the phone. Managed to say, hello, I want to make, and then here it goes. And I just hung up the phone. And, my best friend Sean, comes into the room and says, so where are we going? What are we doing? And I said, nothing. I didn't make it. And I just walked off and he knew. And I just needed time to myself to collect my thoughts and my composure and put on a brave face and face the world. And I think Sean just picked up the phone and made that reservation. So here I was given this first public speaking event. Couldn't even, we finally, probably after 40 tries, we finally got something out on the radio to tell people about this seminar I was putting on. And of course I had to change the words and change the order of the words and work on my breathing and my vision and body, you know, language and so forth, and finally got it out. And that was in 2001. And I just progressed. I just battled through it and did the best I could. And just one day I just accepted that I'm never going to speak. And I just got to the point, I said, okay, you know, I can't be a pilot because whenever you want to take off in an airplane, you talk to the tower and you say permission, right? I couldn't say permission. I couldn't say requesting permission, right? So there's an R and a P there. I couldn't do it to take off. I couldn't do it to land. So there goes my first, I wanted to be a fighter pilot like my father, but if you can't even get on the radio, to call out, you know, your position with the bad guy and all these things. And then to be a private pilot or to fly commercially for an airliner, if I can't even get on there and just say, you know, please, can I take off or please, can I land? You know, I thought, oh my God, this is just horrible. And then I basically said, okay, I'm a dummy. I'm a retard, whatever. I got all this great potential and knowledge and I got all these things that can help, you know, passed on by my mentor. And then through all of my self-financing, self-funding, all the work I had did to continue on this path and this journey to teach and to share and to assist others, I thought, well, I guess I'm screwed. I guess I'll push a broom somewhere because at least I don't have to talk to anybody. And then one day, about a year after probably the worst episode I had, a year later, I woke up and I was 80%. And actually that most difficult time of stuttering for me was, my mother, is this great artist, does beautiful, oils, acrylics, had done some watercolors and some charcoal sketching, but really does great, oil paintings. And she had her first showing in a gallery. And I had this girlfriend, her name was Selena. So there was an S, Selena. And I always had trouble even just saying her name, right? We were living together, sharing a life. And at that showing, that art showing, up comes, my mother's friend's daughter and her fiance. And, my girlfriend had met these people. So this is a first introduction. And I was nervous as I always was. And the words I knew 5 minutes ahead of time, I could not say Selena, you know, hi. I can't remember what the other person's name was, Jovi or something. I said, hi, you know, so in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, hi, Jovi. I'd like to introduce you to my girlfriend, Selena. I just couldn't, I just knew I couldn't, you know, minutes well into advance. And, but I tried it anyway. And then nothing would come out. And, she was mad. Selena was mad. Oh, she was fuming. I was so upset. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I want you to listen to my words. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. Jumped in the car. I remember it was raining that night. It was dark. I was crying as usual, upset. You know, I'm a total idiot, loser, humiliation, anguish, frustration all in one. I remember it was raining. It was raining on the inside, you know, of my eyeballs and raining outside. I barely made it home. Got home. Crawled under my desk, cried myself to sleep, you know, 33 years old, just basically admitted to myself, accepted defeat that I will never speak. She, was so angry. She didn't even phone me that night. She called me the next morning, gave it to me. And I stutter and I just was unable to say your name. And I'm just so sorry. And she was very polite. She said, I didn't know that you stuttered. So I had admitted defeat. Life had gotten the best of me. There's no career I could do. There's public speaking was out, all these things. I mean, every time I got on the phone, have a conversation with the client and it was just this battle. And even with friends, you know, I would stutter around my mother and I would still, she understood and I still felt like a total friggin' idiot. And 1 year later, I remember I got up, I had my home office, my Soho small office, home office, and I'm making my phone calls to clients and, you know, prepping and doing all the mental work that I did, emotional work to have a conversation with as little breaks and stuttering as possible. And I was 80% fluent in English, 80%. And I just don't know what happened. I just spoke. I spoke, like I had never spoken in my life. And I said, wow, I'm onto something here.
Hang on a second. That was really quick. Can we roll that back? and slow forward that. So suddenly there's a point came and you drove, you're in tears. Where did the feeling go? What was the connection that happened? Cause these are the moments. These are the moments
that take you.
These are the ever beyond moments.
I drove home that night. I remember it was cold and rainy. I think it was springtime, late winter, early spring. And, sobbing uncontrollably. I don't know how I kept the car on the road. I mean, it was the worst of the worst. And I got home, got under my desk and curled up in the fetal position and spent the night. I cried myself to sleep, just desperately, desperately praying to God, praying to anything and everything, wishing, wanting that my existence as a human being, when I was born June 8th, 1972 on the Air Force Base, Cold Lake, Air Force Base in Northern Alberta, 7:45 p.m. in the evening. Everything, every word, every deed, every breath, every heartbeat, every smile, every burp, every fart, every giggle, every mistake, every joyous moment. I wish that it was all wiped clean from the slate of the history of our world. I wish I just didn't exist. And that night, I totally gave up. I didn't surrender anything. I don't like that term, surrender. We hear it so often. I just gave up. And every hope and dream that I ever had in my life to live a normal life, every desire, every want, need, desire, hope, every bit of spark of life, I just totally gave up and accepted. I accepted the possibility of worse and actually created a system which has helped me to escape disaster and tragedy. And I use it with clients, have in the past, to go through some of the most impossible circumstances and come out smelling like a rose. I just accepted the fact or the possibility, the very, very distinct possibility that I just would not be able to speak, that I would not have that. Only thing I want in life was that number one was to speak. And I accepted that it just wasn't going to happen. I had given everything in my life, every ounce of energy, just everything that I ever was, am, and would be, from different lives and dimensions and everything else. I gave everything I had based off all of my knowledge, all of my resources, mental, emotional, spiritual, sexual, financial, everything, all wrapped up in one. I gave everything I could to speak and I couldn't. And I accepted that this is who I am. And I now have to have the contingency, which is go to plan B, which is to live a life of this handicap or this disability or this affliction, however I saw it or however you want to label it. I would just have to accept that I would be burdened with this, challenged with this, and that maybe I would just push a broom somewhere and I would just not talk to anybody. It'd be easier that way for me emotionally, just to not go through the humiliation every day. I would sacrifice and give up love. I would sacrifice and give up relationships with people. I would be a mute. I would just be a nobody. I would just be little old me who has this problem, right? I can't change the color of my eyes. They're blue. I can't permanently change the color of my hair. It's blonde. I can't be anything taller or shorter than 6 foot tall. You know, my teeth are a certain way. I can never get a tan. I'm of Czech, Polish, Scottish, and Welsh heritage or descent. I am who I am. I can't change that, and I can't change my speech because Lord knows I tried for, you know, age 6 to 33. So I tried, you know, almost 3 decades, you know, to change. And it's like, okay, I understand that this is what I got and I just have to do it. And I guess maybe little did I know that maybe after that, because I wasn't paying attention because I had already established that this is how it's going to be, that maybe bit by bit, day by day, maybe I got 1% of 1% of 1% better. But it was about a year. It was pretty much a year that maybe, you know, in the 11th or 12th month that I just suddenly woke up one day and I was healed. So I just really had to let it go. And I had to accept the possibility of the worst. That I was going to be this person who could not speak. So maybe that's the moment that I glossed over. Those are all the...
Exactly. I want to roll slowly over, because what you're actually talking about, and this is, right, there's these five stages of grief we talk about. Okay. Now, you were talking earlier on about, you know, Dave specifically having PTSD. I think every human being has PTSD in the DNA. Because of a particular ancient event that happened that we haven't recovered from, and that we're still easily re-triggered into, and this is how mind control works. Yes. And if we can heal that, then we can heal everything else. We can obviate mind control because it won't work anymore. I think this is what we're all working on, a little bit of it. You're obviously talking about some kind of, you know, when you were talking about what happened when your father, I'm not going to do it because it might trigger you, but you say he snapped his fingers sounded like a clock ticking.
Yeah.
You know, so do you get like when you hear a game show and you hear that clock going, do you get the same sort of, anxiety?
No, actually, I don't have any triggers at all.
Interesting.
I have no triggers. Mind you, when I see a very beautiful woman wearing pink, that seems to excite me quite a bit for some reason. But yes. maybe that's just what I like. But,
yeah.
You know, or seeing like a red Ferrari is just wow. Like that's the color a Ferrari should be.
Yeah. Yeah. That sort of, that sort of shiny red with a blonde at the wheel.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know,
I can't explain.
As far as having
no time to explain. Know,
triggers, okay. I'm not triggered like that. You know, I'm very much into self-help, and this stuttering, I mean, I just, so here I am today, probably 96%, and I'm pretty much happy with 96%, but I will tell you that I do have a limitation. And that limitation is I'm just not able to speak a second language. And I'm okay with that. I would love to speak Russian. I've tried. Growing up in Canada, being a bilingual country here, we have French. Did okay with French, but still stuttered horribly through it. I've done...
Oh, yeah, I stuttered through French as well.
Oh, French, yeah. C'est le meilleur.
See, the thing is that as I told you before, my dad was French Canadian, so he spoke with the family accent, you know.
Yeah.
And the worst, I always say, it's the worst accent in the world.
Oh, the Quebecois to me just ruffles my feathers. It's not like that Parisian, that beautiful French, you know, from France accent that is just, you know, so alluring and incredible.
Well, it's descended out of old French sailors, isn't it? And Catholic. Interesting. So that's my Canuck side, you see. But it takes all sorts, you see. It's multicultural, weird sort of cross between English and American and French and American and English. Yes. And Gervais walking down the street. Yeah. And it's like, oh, that's how they do that. Which, how do you know which one is which? Yeah, which one's French and all that. But, you know, Canada just seems to be, the new frontier in some strange way. It's like suddenly everybody's this, oh, look, there's Canada. It's been there all along, yet nobody's noticed.
Which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, people don't really know much about Canada. We're very, very, open-minded, culture, I guess. We're very polite, almost too polite, very hospitable. We're very, very much different than Americans. I mean, hugely different. That's like saying an Aussie and a Kiwi, an Australian and a New Zealander are the same thing. It's just not true. And probably the same thing for Irish, Scottish, and British. Much, much different. Or saying that, you know, oh, you know, Denmark and Sweden, you know, all you guys are Scandinavian, Norway, and you're all the same. No, it is really, really, really different. What is the difference between Scottish and English? Tell me, JP.
Well, they're completely different races. really. I think the
start World War III on the radio.
Yeah, I think the Scots and the Irish and the Welsh and the Cornish and the Basque are all basically branches of the same race, which was Lyran.
Okay.
They're a Lyran colony that got here a long, long time ago, and a lot of them went underground. Some of them managed to survive the thing. And anyway, so that's my thing. And the English, well, they're, you know, Aldebrans, a lot of them, and you know, they make a bad neighborhood, really difficult.
All right,
difficult to be around. Go on.
So here's a rather bizarre or maybe an offensive question is, and I'll just give you some background to sort of qualify. When I lived in Singapore in 2009 to 2011 and had three of the best years of my life and three of the most stressful, but phenomenal, phenomenal experience. You have three major races which make up Singapore. You have the Indians from India, you have the Malay from Malaysia, and then you have the Chinese. And a Singaporean Chinese is much different than a what we call a PRC, or what they call PRC, which is a mainland Chinese. And the Chinese hate the Indians hate the Malay, everybody hates the Malay. The Malay can't stand either the Indians or the Chinese. And what holds them together is rule with an iron fist. I think everybody hates each other. This is kind of a wild statement, but based off my experiences, you know, everybody hates the French. French hate the Germans. The Belgians hate the Dutch. So you have the Flemish. You have probably Scottish hate the English. English hate the Irish. Everybody hates the Irish. But no one wants to talk about this. You know, I had this girlfriend in Singapore, and she even told me that the Chinese even hate the Chinese. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, in my building, she says, we have a neighbor. She says, we never speak. So what do you mean? She says, we've lived in this building for like 20, 30 years. We've never said hello. We never say hi to each other. We pass each other, right? Going to the elevator. We never look at each other or even talk to each other. And I'm like, what's going on? So I think deep down inside, everybody hates everybody. Canadians like Canadians. Do Canadians hate Americans? Yeah. Do Americans hate Canadians? Well, I don't think Americans even know much about Canada at all. It's a very general blanket statement. Now, we could say that it's a rivalry, right? Canadians rival Americans, and we do with our hockey, because hockey is Canada's sport, right? And 70 to 80% of the players who play in the National Hockey League here in North America, they're Canadians. And then we have this rival against the Russians in Canada, and somehow the Canadians hate the Russians and the Russians hate the Canadians. Is this the same feeling? Maybe hate is a harsh word. Maybe it's an accurate word. But would you say that there is a hatred or a rivalry that is disguised as hatred, or vice versa, between British and Scottish, Scottish and Irish, Irish and British?
Well, here's the thing. English.
Your thoughts on that?
It's the English who are like the dominating empire.
Yes.
Yeah. And they're like the remnants of the Roman Empire when they left Roman Empire retreated, but people liked the way it was. So they set up their own version. And, so they've had that. And so the English have kind of made a little, they started out a little empire with, you know, the very peace loving Celts, you know, they dominated them and forced them to fight for them. The Scots fight for them. The Welsh sing for them, and the Cornish mine for them. You know, the English have basically gone around the world and set everybody against themselves and working for the empire. You know, everybody's got their little their little trait that they do, you know.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's, and, you know, who are the English? Who are the English royal family? They're a German, Habsburg, Saxe, Coburg business right. and all that. And who are the Germans but the Aldebarans? Do you know the Aldebarans? They're from the Aldebaran star system.
Yes.
And they're highly, apartheid is their thing.
Right.
They're white supremacist. You know, they're your actual, you know, your original white supremacist.
Right.
And, or the tall white Nordics, they call them. And, so that's like Germany has kind of infiltrated that sort of thing. I've got that sort of thing going. So that's why nobody likes the English, because they're like a sort of proxy German, which is even worse. How was that?
But the English, okay, so you're talking about an outsider hating the English. What about the English hating the Irish or the Scottish? You know, I love English football, soccer or football. I love watching, I don't know, there's something so serene about it. Because being a great hockey fan, you know, hockey's very fast, very violent, very aggressive. And then I watch soccer and it's so gentlemanly. And you're playing on this beautiful green grass field. And then everybody in the stands, the fans, they're singing in unison, in harmony. But then.
Yeah, you're going to get your heads kicked in. Yeah, yeah, really very singing beautifully, in harmony. Yes.
And then a fight breaks out and it's one team's fans against the other team's fans. So yeah. There's hatred there.
It's, what they call war without frontiers.
Oh.
You see, it's like every major country has its football team and its sausages.
Okay.
And, you know, you want to find it, I'll tell you. You want to dig, you just don't need to scratch very hard, to find out nationalism in a person. Just have to ask them who makes the best sausages.
Really?
Yeah, check it out. And the Germans will say, oh, of course, the Germans. I mean, and then the French will say, oh, of course, the French sausage. You know, everybody will, you know, suddenly their nationalism. They might say, oh, yeah, well, I like Manchester United and all that stuff. No, what your sausage is. Well, then you see where people's preferences really are, you know, nationalism. Anyway.
When you talk about English, okay, English and sausage, I can't help think about Jeremy Clarkson talking about the gentleman sausage, but you're not talking about that kind of sausage, are you?
The gentleman sausage? What, you mean the one-eyed trouser snake? The,
Oh, Jeremy Clarkson in Top Gear, best show ever.
Yeah, he's a character. Oh. He certainly is.
Oh my God. Oh, it's just so great to be on the radio with you. I mean, this is a dream. This is a dream come true for me just to sit here and speak and talk.
The fact of your being able to speak is a miracle itself, it seems. And now you see, and here's one of the things that I've been talking to people about recently is that we were waiting for some kind of, you know, great host or speaker to come along and, you know, tell us how we're all going to ascend. And it turns out that we're all here to figure it out between us and like share our stories. And then we go, oh, you too. Oh, that must be a pattern. You know, like you were saying, you see patterns. Right? You know, I'm a programmer. I see patterns too.
Yes.
And, putting it all together, what it turns out to be is that we're given these afflictions in order to overcome them. In order to train us to be the person that we need to be in the time that is now, we had to go through all this to get here. And so anybody who feels that they've had a terribly traumatic childhood and that the world was, you know, up against them at all times, you can now take a breath. In through the nose and out through the mouth. You take a breath and realize that it made you the person who you are today. And if you haven't stepped up, you will be doing very soon because you'll start to get the idea that, oh, hang on, overcoming the challenges that I've overcome, means that I had to figure it out for myself. And look what I've done. I've just worked out a completely new and unique healing system. Ta-da! Yes. How did that work? What a brilliant idea. What a great plan.
And what it is, it's that we have to evolve. We have to be better. We have to be what I refer to as the ultimate version of ourselves. And in my current evolution here right now, I am the best that I've ever been. And I want to be better. I want to be smarter. I want to be funnier. I want to speak better. I want to give great shows. I want to bake a better cake. I love to cook. I want to grill a better steak. I want to make a better contribution. We have to evolve. And if you don't evolve, you're basically dead. You're dead in the water. We have to evolve with technology. We do have to keep up with things. And this means to evolve. And you have to learn. And you have to keep an open mind. And I had my miracle. I went through my challenge and I had my miracle. And for everybody that's listening, you've either had your miracle or your miracle's coming up, or you'll have three miracles in your lifetime. It's very important to recognize these things as a miracle. We have to evolve, we have to grow, and we have to find our truth, and we have to stand in our truth. You know, I was sitting in Singapore, 25th floor, beautiful, high-end, luxurious condo overlooking the ocean. I was 100 meters from the ocean on the east side of Singapore, living in a road called Bayshore Road. No, was it Bayshore? I can't remember. It's been 5 or 6 years. And I remember sitting at the dining room table, and I'm at my laptop as usual, and I'm thinking of my next seminar and developing my ideas, evolving my ideas and my knowledge and so forth. And I remember getting ready to do my third or fourth public speaking seminar in Singapore. And I'm there with my then girlfriend, who actually quit her job, to assist me. And I knew I had to put myself up on YouTube. I thought, okay, Nighty, you want this, you want that, but you have to go through the processes and the steps. And one of the big one was doing this radio show, accepting the offer from Dave. And I remember I was sitting at that dining room table, sitting at the end, and saying, okay, I got to put myself up on YouTube. My God. I lost sleep. It was a week, JP. I didn't eat. I hardly ate anything for a week.
Oh, you poor thing.
Oh, and sleep. I was so nervous. I was so afraid and so nervous, but I knew I had to do it. Same with the radio show. I knew I had to do it. And I'm like, what the hell am I going to talk about? And Dave's like, you can talk about anything you want. I said anything. He said anything at all. I said, oh my God, like where was this content? And you know, basically Dave would have some questions back and forth, but then it just turned into a monologue, you know, an hour long. And I remember freaking out and panicking about putting myself on YouTube. And do you know why? Do you have any idea why I was really, really nervous about putting up videos, short video clips of my seminar on YouTube? Any idea?
Because your suit was mismatched. You had the wrong tie. Your socks were just slightly too short inside your trousers, and you could feel them uncomfortably behind the camera, but nobody would have ever bloody noticed. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Forget Joanna. You're the bomb.
Huh?
Forget Joanna. Everybody should be contacting you. You're good.
You see, I say these things, like, I just make them up as a joke, right? And I'm like, you what? You actually, no. So tell me. I'm just joking, man.
Because I was allowing myself to be judged and criticized. Who is this guy? What is this scribblies on this whiteboard during the seminar? And who is this, you know, like, what is all this stuff? And no, I don't believe in that. This is rubbish, bollocks, bullshit, whatever. It's garbage. This guy's a wanker, a tosser, all in one, right? And then read the comments and all the stuff. And it was fear of being judged. And it was a fear of being judged of me, my words, my mannerisms, my body language, my ideas, my experiences, my knowledge, where it came from. Oh, it's the devil. oh, he's crazy. Oh, this is totally wrong. This goes against everything I, and all these things. I was absolutely freaking out. Couldn't sleep or eat for a week. It was so stressful. And then I threw it up on YouTube. I never had a YouTube channel before. I didn't know how to do all this stuff. And I just put it up there and I sat back and I said, okay, if people want to judge me, that's fine. So I guess I have to evolve to grow into a thicker skin. And I myself have to not be so judgmental of others. So there it is, staring back at me. Don't be so judgmental because people are going to judge me. So let them judge. Let them say what they want to say. Let them eat their cake. It's all right. It's okay. No problem. Whatever. Some people are going to like it. Some people won't. And one thing I've noticed, and it's been brought to my attention many, many times in my life, and even friends back in high school, you know, I'm 16, 17, 18 years old, and they'll say, Knighton, they'll say, people either love you or they hate you. It seems to be no in between. And then I learned something about myself is that I change. I'm an agent of change. I love L. Ron Hubbard's from Scientology fame. He has this saying. He says, when someone's acting up, he says, that's an agent of chaos. So here I am, this agent of change. And I guess if you're sitting in your box, sitting in your prison, and you want to break out, I'm your guy because I can change you. My ideas, my experiences, my life story, whatever. It's going to change you somehow. And maybe you want the change. Maybe you want to break free. And then others will be happy in their box and their prison and everything's under control. It's all good. We're all happy. The Guinness is the right temperature. The cigar is the right flavor. The whiskey is just perfect on the rocks. And that if they listen to what I say or they use it or what have you, that they don't want the change because they're happy in their little control structure. So there I was, freaking out, absolutely upset, but knew that I had to do it. Same with the radio show, knew that I had to do it. And then I just grew into it, I evolved. But I had to go through, you know, I had to shed my skin and I had to die another 30 or 40 deaths and reinvent myself. I've reinvented myself so many times to get to where I am. And maybe I'm going to change another 3, 4, 5 times or 500 times. But it's about the evolution. It's the evolution of being the ultimate version of yourself. My father did not have the tools. He did not have the energy. He did not have the wherewithal. It was just not in him to change. And I'll give you a prime example. We're living in Belgium. And this was 1988. Rechargeable batteries for the Walkman. Of course, you remember the Walkman because you're old like I am. And the Walkman was this, you put your cassette in. And then
I had Walkman Pro.
Oh, my God.
You know.
I have to kowtow to you now because I didn't have the Pro. I just had the Walkman. But mine had auto reverse. Did yours have auto reverse?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
And record, you know, the one.
We're,
was the Pro.
We're having a conversation with royalty. This is fantastic.
Old so people.
It was 2 or 4 AA batteries. And I had rechargeable batteries. And back then, I mean, you buy rechargeable battery and probably after 20, 30 uses, they really begin to degrade. So I decided to buy, just as a backup, because we had a military sponsored coach bus to take us from our homes because I went to an American high school on the base on Shape, Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers, Europe. And it picked up, there's maybe like 11 of us or so. And I listened to my Walkman to school and then on the way home. I really loved Van Halen at the time and Duran Duran. I was a big Durani. Big Durani. My sister got me into Duran Duran. She loved Simon Le Bon. So I decided, okay, these batteries are Shiza. They don't last that long. I'm just going to buy 2 batteries from the base exchange. I even think they were Energizers. Just to have them in case, right? Well, one day my father found the receipt because he was cheap as you know what. And he found the receipt that I had purchased, you know, non-rechargeable batteries. JP, I sat in my bedroom on the corner of my bed. He was standing in the threshold of the door there. And my father was an expert in going over and over and over something. What do you call that? When someone goes over something over and over again.
Browbeat.
Reiteration?
Reiteration, but I would call that man a browbeater.
He was a browbeater. He was a professional browbeater. Yeah. I was 16 years old.
Yeah. And was his father a browbeater as well?
I really don't know that much. I just know his father was a real bastard. But I remember I was sitting on that bed, corner of that bed, and I looked over at my digital alarm clock. 30 minutes straight, over and over, about wasting money on non-rechargeable batteries. I have rechargeable batteries, blah, blah, blah. And after 30 minutes, I was in tears, and I managed to stand up for myself. And when he took a break of air, or maybe he got tired after 30 minutes, I said to him, I said, but Dad, they were only 99 cents.
Ah.
He stopped.
Oh, it was a bargain.
Did an about face and walked off. We never discussed batteries ever again. I think he embarrassed himself.
Oh, so for a 99 cent, he went off on 99 cents.
Yeah.
Essentially. And
yeah. So basically, if you do the math, he was browbeating, he was browbeating, browbeating me at $2 an hour.
And so you know, that's a good, that is interesting. You could charge. Yeah. some people have this thing about, you know, like, what is it they call it? Being a freeman, right? So you carry a little card on you that says, this is how much I charge for my time. And because, you know, if you give me an order, like a restaurant, I will give you the charge and the bill. You see?
Yes.
Yeah. You give an order, you know, so you ask if that's an order. Yes. Well, for that kind of order, I charge £5,000 a foot or something like that. You know, £200 a minute. And then, you know, it's personal, be payable to any policeman or anybody who, decides to want to order you around. It's a really good way of retaining your free will. what do they call it? A bill? Oh, I made up a few. I'll see if I can dig them out. Okay. Norm will remember them. I made them years ago, from a Robert Menard thing. If anybody's in, do you know Robert Menard?
No, that does not ring a bell.
He's another Canuck. He's a Canuck comedian.
Okay.
He's a old comedian. He's a freeman comedian. He's actually very, very astute. And, his children were taken away, the usual story. And in learning how to get them back, he discovered the whole fraud that the government is and all that stuff. So,
yes, okay.
Very interesting fellow. I'd really recommend Menard, M-E-N-A-R-D, Robert okay. Menard. If anybody's interested. Oh, well, it's like everybody's talking about their Walkmans, and now they've got 8-tracks. Vanessa's got a full set of George Carlin on 8-tracks.
Really?
Yeah, it's a big club and we ain't in it.
That guy was a genius.
Yeah. See, again, he saw it. Not everybody sees it.
Incredible. Yeah, he saw it decades ago.
Mm.
And the bottom line again is that we just need to evolve, JP. We need to be better, than what we are, obviously. And some would say that, let's just assume and presume that there are aliens and the aliens are real and they're here. All right. Let's just all agree on that. Whether you think we're nuts or crazy or whatever, let's just assume and let's all agree that that's real. So why are they here? And I would say, well, what's happening to us in this world? And this world is that we are bombarded with continual, unrelenting emotional stimulus. Emotional. Right? So we need to evolve our emotions. And when we evolve, they evolve. And my mentor from New York City, the elite corporate lawyer, L.L. Chopin, he said to me, talking about the Illuminati. Ooh, there's that word, the Illuminati. Because he was basically, in so many levels, in maybe some way, or maybe he wasn't, connected with that group of individuals. And he said to me, he says, He says, they are here to evolve us. All of their ugliness that they do, let's say that they do horrific things and they do horrible things and all these stuff. They just, let's say that there is a group and they do these horrible things to us. His thinking was that they're here to evolve us. But then I say back after having my apprenticeship end 16, 17 years ago and all the things I've gone through my life and experienced and all the books I've read and all the people I've talked to, such as yourself, Simon, everybody else, all my experiences, maybe, just maybe, let's kind of just play with this. Maybe they're not here to evolve us. Maybe we're here to evolve them.
They were given one job. You know, this whole thing, you had one job, right? And they've managed to twist it so that they derive the maximum juice out of it. And they, you know, they dry the juice and then they squeeze the powder and they, you know, compress the powder and squeeze more out of it. Because it's an unsustainable thing. And it's kind of, it's like we're at the end of their, they can't squeeze any more out of us because we're now starting, you know, a lot of people are popping, literally. You were saying it's like they're driving the sheep and there's a guy and he's got a whip and the whip really hurts if it catches the thing, but it makes a big noise. So the noise is enough to say, well, that noise, the thing that makes that noise is going to really hurt. So I'm going to run away from that. And so perhaps as you say, they're making a kind of big kind of so that everybody runs towards the right thing. Kind of thing.
I don't know.
But people are just sitting there having picnics.
Maybe we're here to evolve them. So, major pain, because the whole premise here is just, or I don't know if there is a premise, if that's the right word, getting my thinking straight here, but there's just a lack of compassion, lack of empathy. And one who was born an empath, very sensitive. And maybe my father wasn't really as brutal as he thought he was. It's just that I was just so overly sensitive to everything. But maybe they have no compassion and they're trying to get compassion. They're trying to learn about compassion by being uncompassionate, by being brutal or being terrible. I don't know. Just throwing it out there. Maybe it's something for our listeners to consider. Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe that they're not really here to evolve us through difficulty and hardship. Maybe actually we're here to evolve them, or maybe we will evolve them. It just seems to be taking a really long time, isn't it?
Well, you see, well, look, if you look at it in terms of, in terms of like history, right? Say we look at the last five generations and then we look at where we are, you know, you and I, we're about, you know, we're in the mid 40s to late 50s, 60s, yep. Generation, and you know, after generation, after baby boom and all that stuff. And we're after that. And this is like the gristle on the knuckle. It is the point of compression. We can take a bit of compression. We've got a bit of extra love that enables us to take on their evil and not transmit it to the next generation. That is the job of the light worker, in my humble opinion, that we are all born into terrible, terrible families and we absorb their terrible, terrible evil.
Yeah.
And we experience all the terrible, terrible mind control things and we forgive them because that's our nature. We are by nature highly forgiving, especially if you realize that these people are just addicts and they're just experiencing a bad come down.
This is a really fascinating, I know we're sort of getting close to our ending here, but This is really quite amazing that you've brought this up. And I really haven't shared this with anybody, just close friends. And evil is stupid. And when I talk about evolution and evolving, when I speak like this, it's due to my observation. I'm a great observation of life, and observation is patterns. And I see a pattern with, let's call it evil. Evil will, and evil in whatever form, breast cancer, automobile accident, financial ruin, whatever, getting thrown in jail, break a leg, whatever you want to call it. We'll call it a hardship placed upon you. Evil is stupid. It's like it's a program, and the program has a limitation. And here's what I've observed with friends, family, clients, and so forth. You can have, let's take a guy, okay, we were talking about freedom, right? Free man on the land and have a card and charge people for orders and all these things. So you can have evil in the form of a police officer, a lawyer, a judge, a law system, a court system, whatever. Just, it doesn't matter what it is. Some type of discomfort, hardship, evil has come into your life. There's a saying many years ago, I don't know if it still applies or whether you agree, but you can kick a dog for only so long and two things will happen. The dog will roll over and die, or the dog will bite you back. And evil, I've come to learn in my life and my experiences, is that everything has a purpose. Anger has a purpose. It's to make you feel angry. Joy has a purpose. It's there to make you feel happiness. So you take this hardship, and this hardship has a purpose. And that purpose is to make you feel anger, resentment, frustration, anguish, bitterness, hatred, whatever. Violence, right? You want to get even. You want to destroy the other party. These are all basically emotions that this thing is causing. And I found that this evil force, we'll call it the force, is stupid. It just is there. And a person has a tolerance. We all have a limit. And evil pushes us to our limits. And it actually pushes us to the point where we get smart, we get resourceful, we get clever, we get angry, and we fight back. And we get to the point, you know, it's like, okay, cross this line, and then I will take action. Evil crosses that line. Then you back up 2 feet, cross, you know, draw another line in the sand. Okay, no, cross this line, and then I'll really get mad. And this goes on after cycle, until one point you finally have your back against the wall. Then you come out fighting, you come out swinging, and then you defeat the evil. But we get pushed to the point where we just take it, and we take it, and we take it. And when we take the evil, and the evil comes upon us, it ruins our lives. It makes things very difficult for us. We suffer, and we suffer, and we suffer. And then we get to the point where the evil, if it was smart, if the evil had intelligence, if the evil had strategy and really knew what it was doing, it would not take us to that threshold breaking point where we actually fight back, and then we overcome that, and we destroy that evil. So if there's 10 cycles of, draw a line in the sand, and then, you know, cross this line, and then I'll do something, cross this line, so forth. If evil stopped at the 8th or the 9th, evil would permanently win. And the role of evil is to diminish us. It is to suck our resources out. It is to ruin us, right? It is not to have us feel happiness, not to accomplish our goal. If evil was smart, it would stop at that, JP, but it doesn't. Evil gets to it pushes to the point where we actually fight back in one way, shape, or form, whether it's the boss is sexually harassing you at work, or the guy in traffic's cutting you off, whatever it is. It gets to the point where it pushes just a little bit too far. Then we get pissed. Then we take action, and we stop that, and then that evil, that force, that has been put in our direction to harass us and molest us, to abuse us, gets destroyed. So you tell me, and all of our listeners out there, think about this. Why doesn't the evil just stop and keep us in that little subdued state permanently? No, no, no. Does the evil have an ego? Or does it literally just follow at its course, just like a Donald Trump-inspired cruise missile sailing over to Syria and bombing the chemical weapons plant, supposedly, whatever? Does it have a program? Does it have the set path? And then it just flies and it just affects you? And it doesn't really have a goal of destroying you. It doesn't have a goal of subduing you, keeping you under its thumb. Or is this intelligently designed to get us to that breaking point where we actually take action and then we destroy it? That is the question.
And that's the question we will leave hanging. It's exactly 1 a.m.
Beautiful.
1 a.m. Greenwich. No, actually, it's British summertime. Thank you very much, Knighton. That was a very long hour. It lasted two. Thank you for time traveling with me.
Thank you for having me on, JP. And I look forward to speaking with everybody each Monday night and sharing my stories.
8 p.m. Pacific, knightonwarbeck.com. Thanks very much, my friend.
Thank you.
Let's all go beyond.